Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Shauna Ketchum. She is an art historian at the University of Oklahoma, and she will be in Santa Fe tonight speaking with the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. Welcome, Shauna, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you're an art historian, and you are working with, and you're Native American, you're working with Native American art history. How do you approach that, Native American art history, given that the field of art history is itself such a European set of practices and ways of thinking?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's something that I'm still working on to this day. But it's been very interesting because I think I approach Native American artists and the history of Native American art just from my own background. I try to think of the art in a different way. In some cases, most often I have to think about it in the reverse way, to think about it in new ways that are very different from European practices. So it's really a way of trying to look at it through a community standpoint, and also more about privileging the cultural and traditional aspects of the artists themselves.
So when you say from looking at it from a community standpoint, what do you mean? I mean, are you talking about the art as a community activity as opposed to, you know, the individual genius model of art history? Or
yes, exactly. And I think about it in those terms because most of the artists that I'm interested in are speaking from a community standpoint, meaning that they are interested in furthering the political or social concerns that are emanating from their community. And I think a lot of the best Native American artists are doing so. So they kind of, they transcend that sort of individual white artist genius prototype that's been, you know, prevalent and kind of, just very prevalent in European art history.
What are some examples of Native art and Native artists that are doing that?
I would say an artist, a Cochiti artist that I'm interested in and I've written about is Diego Romero. He's located there in Santa Fe, and he's done a lot of really great work that incorporates Cochiti Pueblo traditions with pottery, as well as inserting some social and political commentary about modern Indian life in New Mexico. So in a lot of cases, he does engage the tourist industry, and he also engages sort of the romantic notions that people have about Pueblo art and pottery in the Southwest. So I think he's one example. Another example I would say would be other artists such as Hulea Sinogeni, who is Navajo, and she's at UC Davis right now, but she's dealt a lot with the imagery of the Navajo Reservation as far as it being seen as a commercialized, commodified imagery of like Monument Valley and places like that, where she states, you know, that it's not a commercial, it's her home. And I think she's speaking for a whole nation in that respect who just kind of wants to transcend that image of having Monument Valley, this place where commercials happen all the time and that tourists can come and view and see, but forget that there are living people there that are dealing with issues, especially one of them in Monument Valley being the uranium mines. And that's something that's come into the larger public arena in the last few years. So I think those are some really good examples of artists that I'm interested in, and especially from the social context from which they work from.
I think it's really important to talk about the fact that dominant culture both romanticizes and at the same time kind of feels superior to indigenous people. Can you talk about that dynamic of romanticizing, but also kind of looking down on people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the romanticism goes hand in hand with the superiority, only because they really reinforce each other. And I think that what Diane Karp has done with the Santa Fe Art Institute and this whole outsider series having to do with tourism, migration, and exile kind of brings about those themes, because tourism is one of the main reasons why people come to Santa Fe and other places around the country. Because I think that people have this romantic notion about Indians being sort of stuck in the past. They have an image of them as sort of vanishing still. And I think there's this sort of escapism involved. And it's sort of a safe thing to engage. If you engage in Indian or Indian places as a tourist, you're sort of dealing with it directly in the same space, but you're safe from it. There's a distance, because I think of the commercialized aspect that is commodified, and so you're able to engage it but not engage it. And of course, that hand in hand goes with the feeling of superiority over those objects of which you are viewing and are not able to talk back to you.
I had a teacher once who taught drawing at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and she talked about this very difficult moment in her class where she had a Native student who was drawing a picture of a coyote howling at the moon, and then a white student came up to him and said, "Hey, that's a cliche." And he said, "Screw you, this is my culture." And she had to really think about what to do in that moment, because there is that aspect of Native people kind of adopting that romanticized view of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that?
This is something, I'm teaching a class right now at the University of Oklahoma, and it's about heritage tourism. And I have Native students and non-Native students in my class. And this issue comes up a lot because, especially here in the Plains area, the symbolism of the war bonnet and other things like that is very prevalent. And some of my Native students are artists, and they're very interested in promoting that image because it does come from their heritage. They might be Cheyenne, they might be Arapaho, so they do have that in their heritage. But of course, the stereotype has been set to where that Plains Indian symbolism is indicative of a general stereotype that's sort of pan-Indian at this point. Mm-hmm. And I do have my non-Indian students saying, well, you're reinforcing the stereotype. And I think that it's a very important issue because it's from two different, very different standpoints. For the Indian student, it's something that they're carrying on, and it's something that is in their everyday experience, whereas with the non-Indian student, they're saying, well, you might be inhibiting, further conversations or any type of getting out of the negative stereotype that it proliferates. But I think that's the kind of the human consequence of all of these issues, especially with tourism, is that they come from very many different standpoints. And I think that, like you said at the beginning of this interview, that the Native American aspect is never, really talked about. And I think that your example of what the kid said about, painting the coyote and the moon is a very good example of that, is that there's no way that Native people have been really able to voice their concerns about their own heritage.
I was wondering what, when you talk about voicing the concerns about your own heritage, is it easier to do that in an indigenous language than in English, for example?
Oh, yeah. That's a very good question. You're totally right. And one of my examples of this, and this is something, of course, that comes up in my class as well, is if you're speaking English and you're trying to convey, concerns from your community in the same language, well, how is that going to translate? A really great conference I went to last fall was at UNM, and it was the Navajo Studies Conference. And I walked into one of the rooms, and everyone in there was speaking Navajo, and they were speaking about issues that were important to them. And I felt really wonderful about that, except that, you know, I'm not very fluent in Navajo at all, but I felt that there was a way that everyone was communicating together and understanding each other, and that there was a lot of the audience that was left out. And I feel that, you know, if you're going to have any type of cross-cultural understanding, that you really kind of need to speak to everyone on the same level as well. And I think that one of the good examples of Native people taking their heritage back is the fact that a lot of tribes are now opening their own tribal museums, and they're actually going to exhibit and promote their own services through their own eyes. And I think that's one of the ways that we are taking it back.
We're talking to art historian Shanna Ketchum. What does tourism do to Native traditions? For example, you know, there's an example of selling Navajo jewelry for tourists, and I guess some people make the argument that it keeps the traditions alive by keeping the crafts going, and other people say that it kind of drains the traditions of their meaning.
Mm-hmm. I think with jewelry making and things like that, I mean, there's a whole lot of innovation that happens from outsider influences, especially, you know, jewelry changing over the centuries. And Navajo jewelry was something that was taught to the Navajo, you know, by the Mexicans and the Spanish. So right there, I mean, you see some types of migration happening and interchange going on, and I think that continues today. I think it only makes the artwork better, and I think that it gives an outlet for Navajo people to make money, for one thing. But I think, you know, it's much more complicated in the sense that it's a very much an economic venture, and of course, when commodification and commercialization come in those aspects, it does get complicated. But I think above and overall that it does make the artwork much more innovative, and it is challenging. It challenges the artist to make new things.
I mean, I guess that also leads to a whole set of questions about collecting art. When somebody, you know, from the dominant culture is collecting indigenous art, be it Navajo, be it, you know, Aboriginal art or whatever, that was not necessarily intended to be collected, especially the more ancient type of work. What's going on? What does it mean when a person or institution starts collecting?
I think the types of art that weren't, you know, meant to be collected could be things that are ceremonial, especially, and things that, you know, the question for me when I think about things like that is why, you know, what is the desire to collect something from a tribe that is ceremonial in significance and has no ceremonial significance outside of the community. In some cases, these things are hurtful and can be hurtful to people on the outside. And I think with the advent of NAGPRA and other laws coming out now concerning indigenous cultural and intellectual property rights, that I think those things are starting to become dealt with. But yes, the whole idea of collection and the souvenir and travel all combined together really has some interesting questions depending on the type of person who is doing these collections, because someone could go to, let's say, Hawaii and want to collect a little hula girl, you know, and take that home, and there's no harm in that, really. It's a significant indicator of where they were. But on the other hand, if someone else wants to collect a very expensive ceremonial object, from the same place? I mean, you know, those types of questions come into place as well.
Yeah.
So it really depends. And I think there's just a wide gamut of types of collectors and types of tourists these days.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because I can't say that I really understand those various psychologies of collecting. I mean, there are collectors who have tremendous expertise and passion for the things they collect, but they're still objects, and somehow when a ceremonial object is collected, it's no longer alive and functional the way it was in context.
Exactly.
But if it stayed in context, it may, you know, return to the earth. But maybe that's the right thing, you know. I don't know how to think about it.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, my students get really—I don't want to say horrified. They get kind of freaked out when I talk about these things, you know, such as maybe a Navajo example, the commercialized sand paintings. You know, those things
right.
were not meant to be made permanent, but there's a huge market now. Four sand paintings that are made permanent on boards, and those things, you know, were very much the community was up in arms over that, you know, when they first came out at the turn of the century. So yeah, I mean,
what
like
are
to
sand
them.
Paintings for originally?
They were originally done in a ceremonial context with a. Healers and families, they were actually done for healing patients. A medicine man would sing over a patient and have a sand painting done either by himself or some of his helpers. And it was a way of helping the patient, but they were also collected and given back to the earth, like you had just mentioned. And they were not meant to be permanent. However, at the turn of the century, anthropologists that had come to the Navajo Nation, for example, Alfred Tauzer, who worked with the Peabody Museum at Harvard, he actually started getting interested in recording, you know, the sand paintings, the designs, and things like that. And of course, it was... a time when anthropology was very much interested in sort of saving, you know, the vanishing Indian. You know, it was a time period when reservations were being built. It was a time period of extreme genocide of a lot of Native populations. And so, of course, you know, it did seem from the outside that, you know, a lot of the indigenous population was dying off. And, of course, in order to save this ceremonial or religious knowledge, they wanted to record it. However, you know, that not being the case today, you know, the Navajo Nation is very strong now, it still didn't prevent the fact that a whole lot of people came into the reservation, traders, anthropologists, et cetera, and have recorded, and museums have collected a lot of these images. And, of course, they are in books, you know, they're in museums, et cetera. And that's sort of how that kind of came out into the public. And so, you know, because there was a market for these sand painting imagery, because they then became ways to decorate your house, they then became kind of permanent in tapestries and rugs as well, and they were all Navajo-made. Usually at that point. And there's a really great book by Nancy Perezo that talks about the sand paintings and the Navajo reactions to it, as well as the reasons for Navajos for making it. And it was largely commercial, because at that point, the Navajo, all their sheep had been slaughtered. They went through... You know, they went to Bosque Redondo. You know, there was no economic viability left on the reservation. So if you have nothing left and no way of living the way you used to live off the land, then, of course, a sand painting done in permanent form, which people on the outside are willing to buy, you know, a lot of, then you kind of have to make those decisions, I think.
I would think that there would be some conflict between, on the one hand, knowing that a sand painting is supposed to return to the earth, and on the other hand, being grateful that it has been preserved when there was so much of an attack against a culture and so much was already lost.
Yeah, definitely.
We're talking to Shanna Ketchum, art historian at the University of Oklahoma. I would think that part of your endeavor is finding language to talk about art, to talk about, you know, visual culture, native culture, in ways that are different from the way it's been defined by you know, Western and, you know, American art history.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think the education that I got at the University of New Mexico was really great in trying to forge some of that discourse. Really great teachers in American art like Kirsten Buick, of course, Dr. Joyce Szabo, and David Craven. The program there at UNM is in art history is very much geared toward trying to figure out a new discourse of writing and talking about non-Western art. As far as I know, you know, I'm still struggling with the thought of doing so in regards to contemporary Native American artists. In a lot of ways, like I mentioned before, I read, you know, a general survey of American art or European art, and a lot of times I have to think of the opposite way of looking at certain theories, et cetera, that I have to think about it in an opposite way and apply that to Native American artists. And I've been working on that for quite a while. I don't have any answers, really, but I know that there needs to be a new way to talk and speak about these artists, especially who have been working, you know, for, you know, over 60, 70 years and haven't gotten the due that they need. I know recently that Jean Quixote Smith, who has been working, you know, quite a long time in the contemporary Native art world, is barely getting an honorary PhD from the University of New Mexico. And I think that's a really wonderful thing that she's finally getting some recognition for all the work that she's pioneered. And I really hope that that continues into the future so that our living artists, our living contemporary Native American artists, are getting recognized and that they are being written about while they're alive. Because I think that a lot of interest in Native American art has been on the objects, and especially older objects and things that are in museums where their makers are not around anymore. So I think that our living artists are very much, you know, the people that are going to help the writers, especially. And I look forward to, you know, talking to more of our artists, you know, while they're still around, definitely.
So that's part of your work is going on the road and finding living artists and talking to them.
Yes, yes, and it's so different, you know, from being, you know, in a classroom or just being here in my office by myself and reading, because I feel that, you know, in a lot of cases that these artists aren't being written about. When I wrote my master's thesis, I wanted to focus on contemporary Native American artists, but I had no primary resources. I had no books. Only one book that has some interviews with some of the contemporary artists, but I didn't have anything. And I think that was one of the major limits of getting a degree in art history, but focusing on Native American art, is that there were no resources. And so I have to, you know, kind of go out on the road. I have to be in contact, and I have to call these artists and speak with them, because, you know, they'll have, you know, a little catalog from here and there, but there has just not been enough coverage, writing-wise, about these artists. And I hope, you know, I hope to help that in some way in the future.
Well, I suppose in some way it it's more true to the spirit of the art you're writing about to get out in the community and talk to people than to sit in an office or a library all by yourself.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. And I'm so grateful. You know, I learned so much from their experience, and I'm grateful every time I get to speak to these artists. Back in, I believe it was 2005, I was invited to Venice, Italy, for a symposium on contemporary Native American art, and I got to meet, you know, like 15 of our current artists, and there was a huge symposium, you know, that was in conjunction with the Robert Storr Symposium, and I got to meet everyone that I ever wanted to meet. And everyone says, you know, we need writers, we need people to be writing about our art, but there's just not enough, you know, younger writers to fill the gap, I think. And I'm just trying to keep up, really.
What will you be speaking about tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute?
I'm going to be speaking tonight about three or four different artists, and I'm trying to encompass my whole talk to deal with both tourism, migration, and exile. I recently wrote a catalog for an artist named Sam Durant, and he did a show at the Massachusetts College of Art last year, and it was called Scenes from the Pilgrim Story. And I really felt that Sam's story about the pilgrims dealt with migration very well, because of course the pilgrims escaped religious persecution in Europe and came to America in hopes of having, you know, the chance to, you know, live a new life and the hopes of being able to. But in the course of that, I also wrote about their interactions with the Wampanoag community. So that was sort of my entree into talking about Native American rights in New England at that time, because the Wampanoag were wiped out from disease and from war and things like that, their land taken. And so I want to talk about that whole show and how history, and especially the heritage industry in the U.S., has focused so much on the pilgrims as the founding fathers of America. There's really a whole lot of filial piety involved in talking about the founding fathers. However, and they believe, you know, that America began in 1620. However, you know, the Indians were here before that. They welcomed the pilgrims. And so I'm going to talk about the sort of interaction between those two. And then in talking about migration as well, I wrote recently about a Chicano artist who is based here in Oklahoma. His name is Narciso Arguelles, and he's dealing with issues having to do with the border, the Minutemen, and so on. Here in Oklahoma recently, last year, the legislature actually passed a law that made it illegal for Mexican immigrants to be in Oklahoma. So it's illegal to harbor any type of immigrants in your home, and it's one of the first states to ever put forth a law like that. So I felt it was very interesting for me to deal with Oklahoma and to talk about the issues of the Mexican migrants here in Middle America. It's very prevalent discussion in California and in Arizona, even New Mexico, but not here in Oklahoma. So I'm going to talk about his installation, which is at the Untitled Art Gallery space in downtown Oklahoma. He set up a kind of faux border in the gallery space, and you have to get a pass to go from one gallery space to the other side.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, it's very interesting. He also has, like, a border guard there kind of patrolling. And he also puts a lot of he used to be part of the Border Art Workshop, which is located in San Diego. So he's been working quite a bit, and I'm really interested in the whole idea of physical borders and how that translates into psychological borders as well.
Sure.
I'm speaking about those two things. And, you know, I'm very interested in the whole idea of migration, like I said, and tourism and exile, because I think that in a lot of cases, when it has to do with artists like Narcisa, who is Chicano, and also in talking about Sam's show with the Wampanoag Confederacy, that there's really a sense of exile going on here in America. And it's not self-exile, it's sort of forced. And I think that a lot of the border issues are very much psychological in as well. So I'm very interested in talking about all those things.
Shanna Ketchum is an art historian at the University of Oklahoma. She will be at Tipton Hall in the campus of the College of Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock giving a lecture with the Santa Fe Art Institute, and she'll be giving a workshop over the next couple of days in collaboration with the Santa Fe Art Institute and the Institute of American Indian Arts. And for more information on that, you can call 424-5050. Shanna Ketchum, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, I'd like to welcome now Rick Namias. He is a photographer and author of The Migrant Project, Contemporary California Farm Workers, published by the University of New Mexico Press, with a foreword by Dolores Huerta. Welcome, Rick, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So how did you embark on this project, documenting the lives of farm workers in California?
It was kind of a multi-pronged thing in my life that kind of brought me to this place. Part of it was a personal reaction to 9/11, and part of it was working for political columnist Arianna Huffington at the time as a writer and researcher, and feeling like I needed to find an issue that I really wanted to merge with my art and politics. I was working as a writer and a screenwriter at the time, and I had only done kind of minimal photography, group shows and things like that, but it seemed like a way for me to get out and, again, merge art and politics in a way that I had been hoping to for some time.
So you document a lot of really horrifying conditions, and it's, in the foreword, Dolores Huerta just says that these horrible conditions have been going on for decades. There's absolutely no reason why they still have to, and yet there they are, and most people don't even know about them. Let's just talk about some of these. Despite the work of Cesar Chavez, there's still very poor protection against pesticides in a lot of places, and you've got pictures of children swimming in irrigation canals. Tell us about that.
Well, that particular image was something that I had heard about kind of mythically through several community workers and different people, but I didn't see it until about halfway through my 8 trips out into the farmland. And when I saw it, I felt there were two things about it that were really striking. One was, here was a family that basically was having an amazing, summer afternoon together. It just happened to be in the middle of a, pesticide-tainted irrigation ditch rather than the YMCA or the beach or anything. And seeing the tightness of community, the tightness of family, which existed even in the face of the adversity, was something that I came against, I saw, several times. And, seeing children who were playing literally feet from pesticide-tainted vineyards was something that was a regular occurrence as well. The thing that amazed me most and still amazes me several years after I took the pictures is that most Americans, even our kind of more left-leaning liberal and even the foodies in this world, don't see the imperative behind rights for farm workers. They often brush it aside as an immigration issue, or it's just kind of invisible and just falls off the radar. Just last week I was at the Kellogg Food Conference in Arizona, which is a gathering of about 600 foodies from around the world, people who are dealing with food policy, people who are really at the cutting edge of stuff. And even there, I have to say, I felt that food labor issues were kind of marginalized.
You say in your introduction that you were taking a course at the Culinary Institute of America, and nobody really even commented on the just lush abundance of food all around you. And I think that's something that many Americans notice when we go to the grocery store. And we don't think about the relation between relatively low prices of food, although that's changing to some extent for other reasons.
Yes, it is.
But and the just unbelievably low wages paid. And in your book, you document not only low wages, but a lot of unpaid, completely and totally unpaid time.
Well, what's kind of crazy, too, is if you look at what's happening today right now, the spike in food prices, it's none of it. None of it is going into the pockets of farm workers. All right. All that money basically is going into people who are driving the trucks, who are basically doing the farming from a grower's perspective, and the multinationals. There's been no real increase of wages for these people whose average income still is hovers around or just below $10,000 a year, which is about half of the national poverty standard. So, I mean, it is amazing to me that, you know, even what we're almost 50 years past Harvest of Shame, we're past, you know, almost 80 years past the FSA and the Dorothea Lange images, that we are still woefully disconnected from the human cost of food. And one of the reasons I did pick California is half of the food in this country comes from my state. And in a sense, California and this book works as a microcosm for national issues. If anything, California farm workers have it better than most other states because they have a higher percentage of unionization through the UFW. But even that is single digit.
We're talking to Rick Namias. A lot of this work is done, as you talk about, by undocumented workers from Latin America, many of them from Mexico. One wonders what would happen if all the undocumented workers were not there doing the work. It seems like they're both terribly oppressed, but also desperately needed.
Well, that's kind of the double edge to this, is we, out of our own selfish needs, need to understand that, first of all, the farm worker issues really are, I think, separate and different from the immigration issue that is being batted around but like this giant baseball in politics. There's no question that we have to address our borders and we have to address security and we have to address a bunch of stuff, but the farm workers are integral to our survival. So if nothing else, out of a selfish interest, Americans need to wake up and start understanding that these are human rights that have to be addressed.
What were the conditions that were most shocking to you when you first started doing this work? I mean, you describe yourself as a, you know, middle-class white man who had even some ambivalence about doing the project. But once you started doing it, what was most shocking to you?
Well, I have to say that the most shocking stuff were the farms that were really quite remote. They were often buried deep in the Central Valley on dirt roads where you really couldn't get to them unless you knew exactly where you were going. They weren't marked. They weren't, you know, even they were off the grid, so to speak. And there you would find barracks or these hideous worker cinder block encampments where mostly men, sometimes families, were virtually kept in indentured servitude. Most of them came from indigenous regions of the Central America and Mexico, so they didn't speak Spanish, which meant that they were totally reliant on people who were often taking advantage of them. And having been smuggled into a couple of those farms literally at the bottom of a van and seeing and smelling the conditions they were living in and they were kept in was really, it was more than an eye-opener. It was something that stuck with me and still sticks with me today.
And you're also referring to a pecking order where there's the, you know, white America on top and then Spanish-speaking workers, and then underneath them, non-Spanish-speaking indigenous people from Mexico.
Absolutely, and even amongst them, there are, you know, the legal Mexican-Americans, there's the undocumented Mexican-American. I mean, there's so many different levels, and what's so horrible is, you know, you can't really draw the analogy to, let's say, 100 years ago when people were coming through Ellis Island and people would often throw out a hand to relatives and countrymen to come over and help them get started. The dog-eat-dog world of farm workers and desperation and poverty, which these people are fleeing, is so severe that, you know, the injustices they often inflict on each other are sometimes really unbelievable.
We're talking to Rick Namias. The book is called The Migrant Project, Contemporary California Farm Workers. Another question that comes up is the schooling of the children under circumstances of continual migration. What happens to the kids?
Well, the kids are often packed up every 2 or 3 months, and they move from one region to another, often probably visiting 2 to 3 regions within any school year. And so their dropout rate is hugely impacted by this, their ability to learn, their ability to grasp language. And as you can probably imagine, psychologically, the impermanence of community and families and things like that just don't exist. So their families become tighter often, but they're often faced with a lot of learning disabilities and a lot of prejudices that the schools are at.
What do people? What are some of the activism that workers are doing and that local leaders are doing to try to get some basic semblance of human rights and workers' rights? I mean, one of the shocking things is that there's not even workman's comp
for
most of these people.
I mean, what's so crazy is the labor laws that were enacted in the 1930s are being held today because of the power of ag business. And you've got child labor laws that allow these kids, 12, 13, 14, to be in the fields, even though they're not their farms. And that's what the labor laws were enacted for, to protect family farms. I have to say, Mary Charlotte, there's not enough going on. There's very little going on. As one of my contributors, Bruce Goldstein, who's the executive director of Farm Worker Justice, and I encourage anyone who's into learning more about this to either check out the Migrant Project website or farmworkerjustice.org, Bruce Goldstein wrote a really strong essay about the issues around the Ag Jobs Bill, which is currently, again, being kicked around through Congress as a first step. And by no means does he or anyone else kind of believe this is the answer to farm workers' problems, but they feel it is putting a foot in the door, you know, a stake in the ground, so to speak, so that things could then be improved upon. But the rest of it is very incremental. We do have some, you know, strong advocates in the California State Assembly doing some stuff, but you know, these people really got screwed over again when this whole, you know, manufactured war on terror came about, and they started, you know, basically calling anyone crossing the border without documents a criminal. So, you know, they've got the baggage of trying to undo all this immigration stuff before you even start looking at the human issues from a political point of view.
I think it's very important to separate those things, as it's very important to remind people, as we sometimes talk about on this show, that immigration violations are not criminal violations; they're civil violations, and the whole, even using the word illegal, you know, casts the whole issue in a harsher light than it really needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing a lot of work around this. I honestly never expected that 5-6 years after I was out in the fields that this would still be a burning passion, and I don't believe that it's really gotten any less so. I mean, I've brought a lot of a lot of people see this work, but one of the most satisfying things, in addition to the book, which I've had a great experience with UNM Press, you guys, I hope you know how lucky you are to have them out in Albuquerque there.
Yeah.
They're just such an open and, I think, can-do organization. And additionally, with them, I'm doing a lot of educational outreach to both grade schools and universities where the work's traveled, to do both workshops, and there's a high school curriculum for the exhibition and the book. And I'm really trying in my own kind of subversive way to get these issues and these ideas in a creative and non-confrontational way into the heads of young kids so they can understand that, yes, the Happy Meal in their hands has a cost. And there were people that have worked and in some cases slaved to get the tomato on that bun.
And I think it's also important to point out that it's not just that the Happy Meal is inexpensive because workers are being paid so little. It's also that way because somebody along the way is making a whole lot of money that isn't being passed down to the workers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the workers, on average are making maybe 7 to 8 cents on the dollar for every dollar they make for, a corporation. And if we talk about just giving them a penny or two more, like the Coalition for Immokalee Workers had successfully done for some time, you know, a dollar or two more per pound for their tomatoes, that would make a huge difference in their livelihood and make virtually no effect on the end consumer. But in that case as well, out in Florida, you've got this amazing grassroots organization that has been agreed to, you know, to take on this new payment plan, and then Burger King turned around and completely screwed them on it. So, I mean, it's amazing the power of corporate America and how they can kind of speak out of one side with the greenwashing and, yes, we're on board with community and consciousness raising, and then just turn around and, you know, pretty much do what they want.
You chose to make these images in black and white, and I was looking at them and thinking, you know, as a photographer, you have to make some kind of tough choices. If you make the images really beautiful, it's hard for the viewer to see how terrible the conditions are that you're describing, and yet as a photographer, you sort of can't help it.
Well, I think you really nailed it. I think there was something that I felt, I mean, quite honestly, I knew when I started out this project, I knew very little about what I was doing on many levels. I talk about that in the preface. And I, you know, I knew how to print black and white. I knew how to shoot black and white. And I knew it was something within my scope of comfortability. The moment I turned it over to color or even digital, which was really just coming in, you know, 5 years ago into a way in which you could really capture this kind of stuff, you know, in a comfortable way, I just felt there were so many unknowns in the work I was about to embark on that why don't I make it a little bit easier on myself and use the Nikon I had shot with for 10, 15 years? Why don't I use black and white, which I know I can process and develop and print myself, and at least have some bit of knowing where I was going on a technical level?
So there's also a lot of precedent for pictures like the ones you've made, and let's talk about Let Us Now Praise Famous Men and Walker Evans. Was that a strong influence for you to
get
started?
You know, it's funny. That came in only about halfway through. What I had really tried to do is I spent about 8 weeks prior to starting the whole project just submerging myself in every kind of white paper and current piece of research I could find. Kurt Organista up at UC Berkeley had kind of led the way with that. He did an amazing paper about HIV and AIDS becoming an epidemic in the farm worker community, which is a whole, you know, interview in itself. But there were numerous things that I was seeing, and what I didn't want to do, though, was kind of get too tied to images that I had seen and either get intimidated by them or try and emulate them. So I really put away everything photographically for pretty much the entire project. One thing I was given, though, was the title of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, which I actually did order on the request of a professor I was working with up in Santa Maria. And quite honestly, when I got home and got that book from eBay, because it was out of print at the time, I opened it up and something kind of rang really eerily familiar. And I opened up my proof sheets, and there, right next to it, I had the proof sheet and the book side by side, were two images that were really kind of startlingly familiar. One was Not Forgotten, which is the migrant grave that's towards the back of the book and exhibition. And then there is the migrant shoes, which is, you know, in my case was about 12 pair of muddy shoes piled outside a single occupancy hotel room in Santa Maria. And Walker Evans has this image of a pair of migrant shoes. Now, I don't think his intent was the same as mine. It could have been, but I thought there was a similarity in the symbolism of where the migrant is and what their shoes, you know, these pieces of materials that cover their feet as they trudge through mud, as they trudge through dirt, as they trudge down paths, they have no idea where they'll end up. And this is what's kind of left of them, both with the shoe and with the grave. And to see a real similar visual tie-in to something taken, you know, in the 1930s, I think it was 1936 or 32, when those Let Us Now Praise Famous Men images were taken, and to have that kind of weird subconscious tie-in to that was a moment when I really felt, okay, I have no idea where this work is going and if it will ever get shown, but I need to finish it just for my own sense of understanding of where it fits into the bigger picture.
And unfortunately, I mean, the sad fact is that it fits all too well into the bigger picture because these things are still going on.
Absolutely. I mean, if nothing else, I really hope with this book and with the exhibition and work I'm doing around it, now, I know that these things cannot on themselves change, you know, policy and all that stuff, but what I hope to do is really look beyond the labor issues and this people stooped over strawberries and get to the human faces and the human stories, so that maybe if we plant a few seeds of compassion with this work, that people can somehow look and see that these are grandparents with grandchildren. These are people who have illnesses like you and me. These are people who have, religious beliefs like you and me. There's any number of things to help humanize them and take them out of the shadows. I feel it will be that much harder to deny them the human rights that they deserve.
Rick Namias, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. The book is called The Migrant Project, Contemporary California Farm Workers, and it's published by the University of New Mexico Press. It has a foreword by Dolores Huerta and a very interesting preface by the author, and then some oral histories and essays in addition to the photographs. Wonderful book. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Just let you know that Photo Eye up in Santa Fe has several signed copies on hand and have been really big supporters of the book as well. So thanks so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks to you.
Take care.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, The Colors of Jazz, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Adios. Thank you.